فیلم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
امام صادق فرمودن دو گروه کمر منو شکستن قطع زهری اسنان.
In a narration by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we read, two groups of people broke my back, the implied scholar and the ignorant worshipper. Being a scholar does not bring a person politeness, and the religious gown and garment do not bring a spiritual perfection. If we want to serve Allah and Imam al-Mahdi Jalallah, we must be serious in our works and try hard on this path.
بخوای آدم ای که میگن خواستن بگی روایت شمینه من جد و جد.
As the famous proverb says, where there is a wish, there is a way. We can't be nurtured by Imam al-Mahdi if we are not serious in our life. There must be a desire in our heart to move us forward. This motivation must be in line with that of Allah and His Ahlul Bayt. Without serious practice and belief, we can't reach salvation in this world and the hereafter. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
in the limelight.
According to a new study, the U.S. is no longer the millionaire magnet it was before the COVID-19 pandemic. Net inflows of high net worth individuals plunged more than 80% last year compared with pre-COVID levels as more wealthy Americans moved abroad. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg noted the U.S. is losing its allure as a residence for millionaires. The net inflow of high net worth individuals plunged more than 80% last year compared with pre-pandemic levels, fueled partly by wealthy Americans seeking new pastures abroad at an unprecedented rate, according to a report by London-based immigration consultant Helene and Partners. RT also had an eye on this issue, writing, America is no longer as tempting a place of residence for world's wealthy as it was before the COVID-19 pandemic. A newly released wealth report by London-based immigration consultancy Helene and Partners has found. According to the report, inflows of high net worth individuals to the country dropped more than 80% last year compared with pre-pandemic levels. The figure fell to just 1,500 millionaires in 2022, from up to 10,800 between 2013 and 2019. The report states that the country is losing its luster among migrating millionaires, and the American dream is now on life support. The report also noted that the countries where the newcomers originate have changed. While previously the majority of applicants for investment migration programs were from developing nations who had weak passports with limited visa-free access and low economic mobility, most of the current newcomers are now from developed countries. According to analysts, the rich are a bellwether for the health of an economy due to their ability to move around the globe freely, and this provides an early warning signal into future country trends. The firm's data shows that back in 2014, the U.S. had the largest net inflows of individuals whose wealth amounts to $1 million or more. However, in 2022, the country occupied only 6th place in this rating, falling behind Australia, Singapore, Canada, and Switzerland. The report stated, people are still coming, but there has been a big increase in people who are leaving. That is what Andrew Amoyles, head of research at New World Health, which assisted in compiling the report, stated. The report noted that a greater number of wealthy Americans have been moving abroad, seeking greener pastures abroad at an unprecedented rate, with some explaining their choice as due to concern over taxes or security. The firm also noted a shift within the country, with smaller cities gaining popularity among wealthy residents, while megapolises like Chicago and New York are seeing large outflows of millionaires. Despite those trends, the U.S. remains the biggest wealth market worth $65 trillion with 770 billionaires, 9,630 people worth $100 million or more, and 5.3 million high net worth individuals, Helene and Partners noted. It is followed by China with $21.7 trillion in private wealth. Also, Forbes noted, one way to tell if a place is doing well is population growth. A city or state that is growing must be doing something right, since people are choosing to move there. Similarly, a place that is shrinking must have some problems, since people feel they need to uproot their lives to achieve their goals. The latest U.S. migration data showed that many people are leaving blue states such as California and New York, as economic policies that deter work and stifle entrepreneurship are partly to blame. A recent blog post from the National Association of Retailers breaks down the U.S. migration data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Florida, Texas, and Carolinas, all red states that lean Republican, experienced the biggest influx of new domestic residents, people moving in from other places within the U.S., while New Jersey, Illinois, New York, and California, long-time blue states that lean Democrat, lost the most people. Florida was also the fastest-growing state in 2022, while New York shrank the most. There are several reasons why some states grow faster than others. One is climate. Studies find that the people have been moving to places with milder winters and more sunshine for several decades now. Colder Midwestern and Northeastern states with harsh winters have an inherent disadvantage, which helps explain population loss in New York, Illinois, and similar places, Forbes stated.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the rules of purification or tahara based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javed, some women claim that the fingernail polish, would not act as a kind of hindrance or barrier for the wuzu, and that it is permissible to do the wiping over the transparent socks.
Yes.
Is that correct? What's your opinion?
Well, I think we have discussed this issue time and time again, and the answer we have given is always the same. Nail polish has a substance that prevents water from reaching the nails. And the allegation or the claim made by some producing companies saying that the polish is water permeable or it is water friendly seems to be unauthenticated. It has not been proven. And therefore, it's important and essential that ladies remove the nail polish before performing wudu or before performing ghusl.
Mm-hmm.
Because the nail polish stands on the nail plates, and of course, the nail plates, seemingly, there's no gap between the nail polish. It's not somewhere above the nail plates. It's mm-hmm. sticking. It is sticking the nail plates. So in order to make sure that water has reached, it is necessary to remove the nail polish. And the polish, whether it is on your toes or on your fingernails, it does not make any difference. For ladies who are, for example, in the state of, let's say, monthly period, okay, they can use nail polish as long as they are in their period, okay? Mm-hmm. But when they want to perform ghusl, they have to make sure that there is no substance, mm-hmm. no barrier or no dirt on their skin or on their nail plates. And nail polish is a kind of dirt,
right,
that prevents water from reaching the skin. And therefore, it should be removed. And when it comes to wiping over the transparent socks, of course, wiping performed on socks is incorrect,
mm-hmm,
because the socks is there, and it forms a barrier. How can you perform wiping on the socks while we are talking about nail polish preventing the water from reaching the skin? So that the same is the case with the socks, which may prevent and which definitely prevent, because there is socks.
If the moisture touches the foot, what happens then? I mean, is that okay?
It might touch partially, okay, but some parts of the upper sole of the feet may remain dry, mm-hmm, and therefore there's no continuity. Some parts may reach, may get the water, and some parts may not, and therefore you are not, mm-hmm, certain whether you have pulled your feet from the toes till the ankles or not.
Yes.
And that's the reason why it's not permissible to wipe on the socks.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of purification based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Javed, is it permissible for those individuals wounded in war who have lost their bladder control due to the severing of the spinal cord, is it permissible for these individuals to attend the Friday congregational sermons or take part in the Friday and afternoon prayers with wudu performed according to the duties of someone who is incontinent for urine?
Well, I know they may participate in a Friday prayer, but as it is obligatory for them to begin the prayer after wudu without delaying, their wudu performed before sermons is not sufficient for the prayer, unless, of course, they know invalidator of wudu, like urination, like passing wind, or and so on and so forth, occurred after wudu. Because for people who are incontinent, for people who are, the problem of passing wind, or people who are, let's say, there's a special term, they call it, I think, flatulent. That's the special term. And people who cannot control their urine or their, you know, passing wind. So these people, actually, when they make wudu, they have to immediately offer their prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And there should not be any gap. Okay. Now, as for these people who suffer from incontinence, they cannot join the prayer because they have to listen to the sermon and then wait for the imam to finish his sermons and then offer the prayer. So yes, that distance is there. And that's why there's this problem will definitely occur. And if the urination takes place, or if the individual passes wind, then he cannot make a perform wudu with it.
Mm-hmm.
He cannot perform prayer with it.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Sheikh Javed, someone gets assistance in making wudu as or because he's unable to perform the wudu on his own. Then he makes intentions and performs the wiping with his own hand, okay? And when unable to do the wiping himself, the assistant takes his hand and does the wiping with it for him. So, and when that cannot be done, the assistant takes the moisture from his hand and does the wiping with it. But what's the rule when he doesn't have hands at all?
That's a good question. Such incidents such may occur with many people, especially in countries where there is war and violence and people engage in fighting. And so catastrophes happen. So His Eminence actually says that if a person does not have a palm, the moisture would be taken from his forearm. And if there is no forearm, the moisture would be taken from his beard and or maybe from eyebrow. In the event that he does not have beard, of course, the moisture is taken from his eyebrow. And with that moisture, the wiping of the head and the feet is carried out, you know. So I think this is an answer to a question that you asked earlier when we were discussing this issue, that in the event that one does not have an arm to wipe the feet, so someone else can do it. Someone else can take the water from his beard or from his eyebrows and pull over his feet. Because he doesn't have four arms, so he can do it, and someone else can do it.
I see. Okay. Sheikh Javid, most of the time you would find a kind of public convenience affiliated or built close by, I mean, near the mosques.
Yes.
All right? And near the place where sometimes the Friday prayer is performed, there's also that kind of a place which is affiliated and specified for people or the mosque goers to make wudu in them for themselves, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the water bill is not even paid for by the budget of the mosque, all right? Is
yes.
it permissible for those individuals who go to the mosque, the same mosque, to perform the Friday prayer to use the same water for the wudu?
Well, His Eminence, in an answer given to this question, he has said that as the water is prepared for performing wudu, for all those who perform prayers in that place or in that Jami Masjid or central mosque, of course, now without any restrictions, you know, there's no restriction as to who should do it, who shouldn't do it. Of course, the water is there for all mu'mineen to use.
Yes.
So there's no problem in using that water to make wudu, and therefore there wouldn't be any problem with regard to the wudu and the prayers they perform.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم مجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding prominent Shiite scholars and thinkers all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Om, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding fuqaha and the Shia mutakallimin of the 8th century Hijra, the author of more than 120 books. He is no one but Hassan ibn Yusuf ibn Mutahhar Hilli, mainly known as Allama Hilli. Allama means polymath. His books are really welcomed by most of the scholars and Shia scholars, and his role in spreading Shia Islam, especially in old Persia, is really outstanding. We'll talk more about this aspect of his life, but let's be more familiar with the early life of Allama Hilli from your tongue. The person who is believed for the first time in the history has been titled as Ayatollah. Okay, Allama Hilli. Okay, who is Allama Hilli, Sayyid Mohsen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Allama Hilli was born in 648 Hijri Qamari in Hilla. And Hilla is a place between the Karbala and Najaf. Mm-hmm. And obviously, he was amongst the, we can say, mutakallimin, the theologian, the Shia theologian. He was a scholar of the Ilm al-Usul. Obviously, before him, the Akhbariyun were very much famous, but he got famous because of the Usul, following the path of Usuliyun. And obviously, he was a great scholar in the jurisprudence and the logic and philosophy, because he got all those things. And he reached to the level of Ijtihad, why he was known as Ayatollah as well.
Yes.
And because of him having the knowledge of multiple, we can say, sciences, he was known as the sign of Allah. Mm-hmm. That a person, you know, because the word, even when we say Allame for yes. the Hilli, Allame is the one who has command over the different sciences.
A polymath. Yes.
So basically, that's why the word Allama is used with mm-hmm. him.
Okay.
And due to this reason, at that time, they used to call him the sign of Allah, that obviously in praise of him. That we haven't seen such a person who is fallible and he has reached to this level. So that's why he was also known as the Ayatollah. On the other hand, we can see like Allama Baqir Majlisi and Sheikh Bahai, they had the permission from the students of Allama Hilli, where it was written that he was Ayatollah fil alamin.
Mm-hmm.
He is the sign of Allah in the worlds.
Okay.
So it shows the rank and the status of this personality, that how big he was and the status that he had. So basically, he has learned the Quran from his father and the other things from his father and his mother's brother. We say like uncle.
That's right.
Because we have specific word in Persian and Urdu, mm-hmm. Even in the Arabic. You know, for the mother's brother. But when we say in English, it's just uncle, it's uncle.
Yes.
It can be the father's okay. brother or the mother's.
Yes.
So it was basically Muhaqqiq Hilli. We have two Hillis.
Like, yeah, Muhaqqiq Hilli was his master.
His master, and
yes.
he was his mother's brother,
yes.
his uncle, basically.
And after the demise of Muhaqqiq Hilli, most of the students refer to yes. Allama Hilli now.
Yes.
And you know, he was 28 years old.
Yes.
At the very young age, he reached somehow the status of marja'iyya, marja'iyyatul am of Shia in the Hilla on that time, one of the most.
And that was even
centers.
Because he was at that rank before that.
Okay.
You know, he was at that point before that, because in some traditions or the historians or scholars, they have mentioned that he became the mujtahid, or he reached to that rank at the age of 13 or 14.
Yes.
But because Muhaqqiq Hilli was there.
Yes.
The students were not going towards this young, we can
young
say, like,
kid.
Young kid.
Teen,
and he,
okay.
and they maybe they purposefully has hide this kid from the general public and didn't show.
Okay.
But after Muhaqqiq Hilli, since his age was too young, like 28, 29, so he got famous after him.
Sheikh Rouhani, the exact date of his entrance to Persia is not known, but his role in spreading the Shia Islam in Iran is really famous. What was the exact story?
Yes, there are many famous stories regarding this Allama al-Hilli, rahmatullahi alayhi. So one of them, as you rightly mentioned, his entrance to Iran, to Persia at that time, is this that at that time, Sultan, the king Muhammad Khudabanda, one of the Mongols' king and Salatin in Iran, of course, he was ruling over this area, and he was Sunni. Of course, the Sunni scholars were at that time in his castle with him as the consuls, as the advisors. And, of course, when he came to Iran, he had lots of debates, discussion with these Sunni scholars. As a result of these debates with the Sunni scholars, where some of them were in the presence of the king, he actually proved the truthfulness of the Tashayyu, Madhhab al-Shia, in front, in the presence of the king, Sultan Muhammad Khudabande. In one of those meetings that was held in the presence of the king, with the presence of many scholars, the Sunni scholars, he proved the truthfulness of this madhab, I mean tashayyu. And then as a result of this debate, the king, Sultan Muhammad Khudabande, converted to tashayyu.
What was his name, Sultan Muhammad Khudabande?
Sultan Muhammad Khudabande.
From beginning, was his name, original name this, or no? Then it was changed.
It was changed because he was Mongol, one of the Mongol kings.
The Ilkhanites.
Yeah, Ilkhanites,
okay.
yes.
Okay.
And of course, it was this Allama al-Hilli, rahmatullah alayhi, has a very great book on Imam Ali's truthfulness of Khilafah and Imamah, which is called Minhaj al-Karama. If you read Minhaj al-Karama, in that book, Allama al-Hilli proved the authenticity or the, let's say, truthfulness of his imamate based on Quran, ayat and riwayat, and hadith. The traditions and history, and finally the aql. It is a very good book. It is a very nice book, which later was criticized by Ibn Taymiyyah.
That's right.
Ibn Taymiyyah criticized that book and this mazhab of Wahhabi based on that doctrines established by him, opposing to this were main and very outstanding work of Allama al-Hilli. There are two more very nice stories about Allama al-Hilli I wanted to mention.
Yes.
This is that according to, based on these narrations or these stories,
yes.
He actually visited or saw the Imam, the 12th Imam.
Imam al-Asr.
Imam al-Asr, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif. It is said about him that once he borrowed a book from one of the Sunni scholars, and he had to copy that book in one single night.
Okay.
So he started to copy that book to write from the text, I mean himself by his own hand, but at the middle of the night he got tired and he did not have any more energy to copy that, and then at the same time he had to finish the book in one single night. So then he was actually confused what to do. Suddenly he saw a very young man, a beautiful young Sayyid, came to him and asked him that I can help you. He said, oh, tonight I cannot accept any guests because I have to finish
this book.
Yeah, please go.
Ascribing
yeah,
this
yeah,
book.
I have to finish this. I cannot accept any guests tonight. He said, so I will help you. I can help you. He said that you're so young, it's difficult, this text is difficult, and you have to write it very correctly, exactly, beautifully. And then it is said that he tested him. Allama al-Hilli tested, asked him a question and asked him to write. First he wrote in a way, then he said, I can write better than this.
Okay.
Said, okay. Finally he said that, okay, he can write better than me even.
Okay.
And then he left the book for him and said, okay, please copy it. I want to had a short nap.
Nap.
Yeah. And then when he woke up, Allama al-Hilli, when he woke up, he saw that, okay, the book was written completely till the end of the book in the most authentic and perfect way. And then he understood that, okay, this young man was not a normal man. Because this book was a difficult book and it had lots of technical terms. It is a fiqh book, for example. And how could he finish in one single night? Mm-hmm. I got tired just, for example, some pages I just I've just written. This is one of these stories that Allama al-Hilli says that it was the only the 12th Imam can do this. Otherwise, the other people cannot do it. And the other one is that in one of his journey to Karbala, he was just walking towards Karbala and he saw then a young man, a very scholarly figure. And he started talking with him, asking many difficult questions from that young man. He answered all of the questions that, you know, when a scholar have questions, they're really difficult questions.
Yes.
And it, once then when he was asking him, he was answering all the questions. Then finally he asked this question that, oh young man, oh great scholar, respected scholar, is it possible to visit or to see the 12th Imam? Then, stick in his hand, Allama al-Hilli.
Yes.
It was suddenly fell down. And then that man, Imam al-Zaman, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif, give it back to Allama al-Hilli, hand to hand.
Yes.
He said, why isn't it possible? Why the hand of the Imam is right now in your hand? And then, of course, at this occasion, Imam ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif mentioned him a very important hadith in one of the Shiite sources. He said that you have to refer to that hadith, and then this hukm that you are asking is mentioned in that hadith, of that book, for example. It was one of the book of Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi, if I'm not mistaken, in Tahzib, I think. And then later when Allama al-Hilli referred to that book, find out the exact hadith, and in commentary on that hadith, he wrote that I was informed of this hadith by the 12th Imam.
It was
written by Allama al-Hilli himself, that Imam ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif mentioned this hadith, and I was informed of this hadith by the Imam. So this was really nice.
It shows the highest status of
Allama al-Hilli. Rahmatullahi alayhi.
That's right. Very good.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. So what about his books, his compilations, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi?
According to himself, Allama al-Hilli has said that he had 57 books that he has obviously he wrote. And obviously the status that he had, obviously we can find some of the other scholars have mentioned that, for example, he had 95 books. Maybe when Allama al-Hilli has wrote about himself, it wasn't completed, the rest of them. So there are different things that were made by Allah or that were written by Allah Mahili. For example, Mukhtalif al-Shi'a, Tazkiratul Fuqaha. In the fiqh, we have Kashful Murad. We have Babi Hadi Ashar, Minhaj al-Karama. In the theology, we have, you know, the book, which is Khulasatul Aqwal. And Jawharun Nadid, one of the... we can say magnificent books in logic. You know, generally we study logic, but the one who studies Jawharun Nadid, he goes to the next level, to extraordinary level.
Okay.
So basically, these are the books which were written by Allama al-Hilli. And even in today's time, Kashful Murad has been taught in the Hawza. You know, Kashful Murad is one of the books for the theology, in the theology.
Okay.
And generally, in the Hawza, they teach it at the master level. They don't even teach it at the graduation level.
Because at the primary level,
Not the primary level. We can say like the graduation.
Graduation,
it should
yes.
be in the master's
advanced
level.
Advanced ones.
It's not under the graduate. Postgraduate, for example.
Yes, that's right.
Why? Because you have to learn a lot of things in order to understand this book.
Okay.
So we have Tazkiratul Fuqaha as the Fiqhi, Mukhtalafut Shia as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest were in the theology and Khulasatul Aqwal as the Ilm al-Rijal. These were the things which were written by Allama Hilli. And on top of that, it is better to mention about his teacher, because yes. We have mentioned from whom he benefited.
Yes.
Sayyid ibn Taus is one of the teachers, Al-Muhaqqiq Hilli. It was Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi. And we have the name, Yahya bin Sa'id Hilli.
Yes.
And amongst his, we can say like students, we have Qutbuddin Razi. These are the famous names that generally people know. Otherwise, there are many students.
Yes.
But obviously, Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin.
Yes.
The son of Allama.
Okay.
Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin is the one who wrote the book of Ma'alim,
yes,
basically.
Okay.
And he was also one of the greatest scholars.
That's right.
So this is the basically overall introduction, we can say, like of the Allama Hilli.
That's all right. This outstanding man passed away on Muharram 21st, 726, according to the Hijra count, at the age of 78. We can say in the city of Hilla, because after the demise of Sultan Muhammad Khodabandi, he migrates again back to Hilla and resides over there up until the end of his life. And his body was taken into the holy shrine of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam in the city of Najaf, and he is buried over there today, the visiting place of so many Muslims and Shiite Muslims all across the world. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Hassan ibn Yusuf ibn Mutahhar al-Hilli, mainly known as Allama al-Hilli. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information on this program and other episodes, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Despite calls for dialogue and a peaceful solution to end the conflict, Western nations, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine, including heavy military equipment. This trend has only escalated the conflict, and prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Also, it seems that Ukraine's allies are gearing up for a much longer war. In his first trip to Ukraine since the beginning of the conflict, U.S. President Joe Biden met with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. During his hours-long surprise visit to Kyiv, Biden said he was there to show his country's unwavering support for Ukraine.
And I'm here to show our unwavering support for the nation's independence, their sovereignty, and territorial integrity. And today, I hope we're going to have a chance to discuss on the United States and our allies, by keeping constant contact with them, our partners, can most effectively support you and your cause, Mr. President.
And later, at a joint presser with Zelensky, Biden promised increased arms deliveries to Ukraine.
We've committed nearly 700 tanks and thousands of armored vehicles, 1,000 artillery systems, more than 2 million rounds of artillery ammunition, more than 50 advanced launch rocket systems, anti-ship and air defense systems, all defend Ukraine. And that doesn't count
The other $500 million we're going to be announcing with you today and tomorrow.
Zelensky hailed the visit as a key sign of support, saying Russia does not stand a chance of winning the war.
This is an unequivocal signal that Russian attempts to win will have no chance. Together, we will protect our cities and our people from the terror of Russia.
While Biden was in Kyiv, the U.S. State Department announced a further $460 million in aid to Ukraine. The assistance includes $450 million in artillery ammunition, anti-armor systems, and air radars, as well as $10 million for energy infrastructure. Biden's visit to Ukraine was the first trip to the country by a U.S. president in 15 years. The visit came 4 days before the first anniversary of the breakout of the war between Ukraine and Russia. Moscow has repeatedly warned the West against providing Kyiv with weapons, saying it would only prolong the conflict. Now, Biden's trip has clearly sent a contradictory message to Moscow. That is, the influx of weapons to Ukraine will continue and that Washington exactly wants the war to go on. Since the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine, Western countries, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending arms to the country rather than supporting dialogue. Now, the U.S. has accused China of planning to send weapons to Russia in its war with Ukraine, warning Beijing that any supplies would cause a serious problem.
We have seen Chinese companies, and of course in China there's really no distinction between private companies and the state. We have seen them provide non-lethal support to Russia for use in Ukraine. The concern that we have now is based on information we have that they're considering providing lethal support. And we've made very clear to them that that would cause a serious problem for us and in our relationship.
Blinken said he had made it clear to his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, during the Munich Security Conference that Beijing would face consequences if it moved ahead with assisting Russia in the war. The warning comes as the U.S. has been the largest provider of weapons to Ukraine during the year-long war with Russia. In reaction to Blinken's comments, China rejected the accusation, saying it's the Americans who are endlessly shipping weapons to the battlefield.
It is the U.S., not China, that is providing a steady stream of weapons on the battlefield. The United States is in no position to make demands of China. We will never accept the U.S. pointing fingers at Sino-Russian relations or even cursing us.
China has expressed deep concern over the Ukraine conflict getting out of control. Beijing has also urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire while pledging to promote dialogue to resolve the conflict.
There is no end in sight to the Israeli atrocities in the region. In a latest development, the regime carried out yet another airstrike near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Several people were killed and over a dozen injured. The attack heavily damaged nearby residential buildings. That after missiles hit the densely populated Kafar Susa neighborhood in central Damascus, where a security complex was located. One soldier was also said to have been killed as a result. The Syrian military said the air defense confronted what it called hostile targets in the sky around Damascus. Rights groups said the latest Israeli strike was the deadliest in the Syrian capital since last month, when another missile attack targeting Damascus International Airport left 4 people dead. The latest attack, like usual, drew strong condemnation from Damascus. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called the strike a crime against humanity. Iran and Russia separately condemned the attack. Iran's Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani slammed the West's, quote, shameful silence over repeated violations of Syria's sovereignty. Kanani called on the UN Security Council to react to the latest attack by Israel.
Russia also called the assault a flagrant violation of international law. Moscow warned of what it called dire consequences for the region. The Israeli assault came days after over 50 people were killed in an ambush carried out by Daesh terror group in Syria's central desert province of Homs. Syrian media said the bodies of all victims taken to a state hospital had gunshot wounds to the head. Recent attacks carried out by the Israeli regime and the Daesh terror group come at a time when Syria is grappling with one of the deadliest earthquakes of all time in the history of the country. So far, nearly 6,000 people have died in Syria's recent earthquake. As the Syrian foreign ministry put it, at a time when Syria was trying to heal its wounds, bury its martyrs, and receive condolences, sympathy, and international humanitarian support in facing the devastating earthquake, the Israeli entity launched an air aggression targeting the civilian populated residential neighborhoods in Damascus. Faisal Maghdad called on the United Nations Secretariat and UN Security Council to condemn the regime's aggression and hold it accountable for its crimes. Syria has been repeatedly complaining to the UN over Israeli repeated assaults, urging the Security Council to take action against Tel Aviv's crimes, but those calls have all fallen on deaf ears. The international community has failed to take a single action in at least condemning such attacks. That comes to the spotlight, especially at a time when the United States maintains its occupation of Syria's eastern oil-rich provinces to steal the country's reserves. There are reports that the Americans load tankers and trucks with oil and wheat and send them over the border to Iraq. The U.S. occupation of oil-rich Syria, the Daesh terror attacks there, and the repeated Israeli missile strikes against the Arab country all take one to the conclusion that Washington and its allies still haven't given up in trying to destroy Syria. Not only one cannot expect any condemnation from Western countries with regards to the matters, there seems to be no international community who would want to do anything. After all, their interests lie in not taking any action. All in all, what seems to be crystal clear is the fact that Syria is still being punished for stopping the plans of those who wanted to create a new Middle East. That makes it even more auspicious when countries which were once hopeful of establishing a new government in Damascus are now normalizing relations with Syria.
Protesters have returned to major cities across Europe to voice their anger at the rising cost of living across the continent. In Spain, people held a massive rally in Madrid against what they call the regional government's dismantling of the public healthcare system. Officials say 250,000 people turned out, but organizers put the number as high as a million. That is the largest such demonstration in recent months. Protesters accuse the regional government of prioritizing private health. They say the public health service is suffering from staff and equipment shortages because of the government's policies. Some primary care doctors and healthcare workers have also been holding regular strikes over better working conditions and pay.
The condition of the public health system is deteriorating. The number of doctors have been decreasing with medical conditions getting worse. Many medical centers have been closed.
The region's right-wing leader has repeatedly claimed that the protesters are motivated by political interests. And in the Portuguese city of Lisbon, tens of thousands of teachers have taken to the streets amid public discontent over the cost of living crisis. It is the third time in less than a month that teachers and school workers have held mass demonstrations. Teachers want a pay rise and are also calling on the government to speed up career progression. Officials say negotiations with teachers' unions are ongoing and express hope that an agreement would be reached soon. Portugal is one of Western Europe's poorest countries, which is